Moist ran back to the bank and straight to the little door under the stairs. He liked it down in the undercroft. It was cool and peaceful, apart from the gurgling of the glooper and the screams. That last bit was wrong, wasn't it? The pink poisons of involuntary insomnia slopped around in his head as he broke into a run. The former Owlswick was sitting in a chair, apparently clean-shaven except for a pointy little beard. Some kind of metal helmet had been attached to his head, and from it wires ran down into some glowing, clicking device that only an Igor would want to understand. The air smelled of thunderstorms. "What are you doing to this poor man?" Moist yelled. "Changing his mind, sir," said Igor, pulling a huge knife switch. The helmet buzzed, clamped, blinked.
"It tickles," he said, "and for some reason it tastes of strawberries." "You're putting lightning right into his head," said Moist. "That's barbaric."
"No, sir. Barbarians don't have the capabilities," said Igor smoothly. "All I'm doing, sir, is taking out all the bad memories and storing them."
Here he pulled a cloth aside to reveal a big jar full of green liquid, containing something rounded and studded with still more wires.
"Into this."
"You're putting his brain into a parsnip?"
"It's a turnip," said Igor.
"It's amazing what they can do, isn't it?"
said a voice by Moist's elbow. He looked down. Mr. Clamp, now helmetless, beamed up at him. He looked shiny and alert, like a better class of shoe salesman. Igor had even managed a suit transplant.
"Are you all right?" said Moist.
"Fine."
"What did it feel like?"
"Hard to explain," said Clamp, "but it sounded like the smell of raspberries tastes."
"Really? Oh, I suppose that's all right then. And you really feel okay in yourself?"
said Moist, probing for the dreadful drawback. It had to be there, but Owl's exorbit looked happy and full of confidence and vim, a man ready to take what life threw at him and knock it out of the court. Igor was winding up his wiring with what, under all those scars, was a very smug look on what was probably his face. Moist felt a pang of guilt. He was an Überwald boy. He'd come down the villainous path just like everyone else, trying to seek his fortune, correction, everybody else's fortune, and he had no right to pick up the fashionable lowland prejudice against the clan of Igors. After all, didn't they simply put into practice what so many priests professed to believe? That the body was just a rather heavy, cheap suit, clothing the invisible, everlasting soul, and therefore, swapping around bits and pieces like spare parts, was surely no worse than running a shonky shop for used clothing. It was a constant source of hurt amazement to Igors that people couldn't see that this was both sensible and provident, at least up until the time when the axe slipped and you needed someone to lend a hand in a hurry. At a time like that, even an Igor looked good. Mostly they looked serviceable. Igors, with their obliviousness to pain, wonderful healing powers, and marvellous ability to carry out surgery on themselves with the aid of a hand mirror, could presumably not look like a stumpy butler who'd been left in the rain for a month. Igorinas always looked stunning, but there was always something. A beautifully curved scar under one eye, a ring of decorative stitching around a wrist. That was for the look. That was always disconcerting, but an Igor always had his heart in the right place. Or a heart, at least.
Well done, Igor, Moist managed. Ready to make a start on the old dollar bill, then, Mr. Clamp?
Mr. Clamp's smile was full of sunbeams.
Done it, he announced. Did it this morning.
Surely not.
Indeed I have. Come and see.
The little man walked over to a table and lifted a sheet of paper. The banknote gleamed in purple and gold. It gave off money in rays. It seemed to float above the paper like a small magic carpet. It said wealth and mystery and tradition.
"We're going to make so much money," said Moist.
"We'd better," he added to himself. "We'll need to print at least 600,000 of these, unless I can come up with some bigger denominations." But there it was, so beautiful you wanted to cry and make lots more like it and put them in your wallet. "How did you do it so quickly?"
"Well, a lot of it is just geometry," said Mr. Clamp. "Mr. Igor here was kind enough to make me a little device which was a great help there. It's not finished, of course, and I haven't even started on the other side yet. I think I'll make a start on that now, in fact, while I'm still fresh."
"You think you can do better?"
said Moist, awed in the presence of genius.
"I feel so full of energy," said Clamp.
"That would be the electrical fluid, I expect," said Moist.
"No, I mean, I can see so clearly what needs to be done. Before, it was all like some horrible weight I had to lift, but now everything is clear and light."
"Well, I'm glad to hear it," said Moist, not entirely certain that he was. "Do excuse me, I have a bank to run." He hurried through the arches and entered the main hall via the unassuming door, in time to very nearly collide with Bent.
"Ah, Mr. Litwick, I wondered where you were. Is this going to be important, Mr. Bent?"
The chief cashier looked offended, as if he'd ever trouble Moist about anything that was not important.
"There are lots of men outside the mint," he said, "with trolls and carts. They say you want them to install a..." Bent shuddered. "A printing engine."
"That's right," said Moist. "They're from Teamer and Spools. We must print the money here. It'll look more official, and we can control what goes out of the doors."
"Mr. Litwick, you are turning the bank into a circus."
"Well, I'm the man with the top hat, Mr. Bent, so I suppose I'm the ringmaster." He said it with a laugh to lighten the mood a little, but Bent's face was a sudden thundercloud.
"Really, Mr. Litwick, and whoever told you the ringmaster runs the circus, you are very much mistaken, sir. Why are you cutting off the other shareholders?"
"Because they don't know what a bank is about. Come with me to the mint, will you?" He strode through the main hall, having to dodge and weave between the queues.
"And do you know what a bank is about, do you, sir?" said Bent, following behind in his jerky flamingo step.
"I'm learning." "Why do we have one queue in front of each clerk?" Moist demanded. "It means that if one customer takes up a lot of time, the whole queue has to wait. Then they'll start hopping sideways from one queue to another, and the next thing you know, someone has a nasty head wound. Have one big queue, and tell people to go to the next clerk free. People don't mind a long queue if they can see it's moving. Sorry, sir." This was to a customer he'd collided with, who steadied himself, grinned at Moist, and spoke in a voice from a past that should have stayed buried.
"Why, if it isn't my old friend Albert, you're doing well for yourself, ain't you?"
The stranger went on, spluttering the words through ill-fitting teeth. "You in your suit of lights?" Moist's past life flashed before his eyes. He didn't even need to go to the bother of dying, although he felt as though he was going to. It was Cribbins. It could only be Cribbins. Moist's memory sandbagged him, one bag after another. The teeth! Those damn false teeth! They were that man's pride and joy. He'd prized them out of the mouth of an old man he'd robbed while the poor devil lay dying of fear. He'd joked that they had a mind of their own, and they spluttered and popped and slurped and fitted so badly that they once turned around in his mouth and bit him in the throat. He used to take them out and talk to them. And, ah, they were so old, and the stained teeth had been carved from walrus ivory, and the spring was so strong that sometimes it had forced the top of his head back so that you could see right up his nose. It all came back like a bad oyster. He was just Cribbins. No one knew his first name. They'd teamed up, 10 years ago, and they'd run the old legacy con in Uberwald one winter. He was much older than Moist, and still had the serious personal problem that made him smell of bananas. And he was a nasty piece of work. Professionals had their pride. There had to be some people you wouldn't rob, some things you didn't steal. And you had to have style. If you didn't have style, you'd never fly. Cribbins didn't have style. He wasn't violent, unless there was absolutely no chance of retaliation, but there was some generalised, wretched, wheedling malice about the man that had got on Moist's soul.
"Is there a problem, Mr. Litwick?" said Bent, glaring at Cribbins.
"What? No, said Moist. It's a shakedown, he thought. That bloody picture in the paper. But he can't prove a thing, not a thing.
"You're mistaken, sir," said Moist. He looked around. The queues were moving, and no one was paying them any attention.
Cribbins put his head on one side and gave Moist an amused look.
"Mistaken, sir? Could be. I could be mistaken. Life on the road, making new chums every day, you know. Well, you wouldn't, would you, on account of not being Albert Spangler? Funny, though, 'cause you have his smile, sir. Hard to change a man's smile, and your smile is, like, in front of your face, like you is looking out from behind it. Just like young Albert's smile. Bright lad he was, very quick, I taught him everything he knew."
And that took about 10 minutes, Moist thought, and a year to forget some of it. You're the sort that gives criminals a bad name.
course, sir, you're wondering, can the leopard change his shorts? Can that old rascal I knew all them years ago have forsook the wide and wobbly for the straight and narrow?
He glanced at Moist and amended,
Whoops! No, course you ain't, on account of you never seeing me before. But I was scrobbled in Pseudopolis, you see, thrown into the clink for malicious lingering, and that's where I found Om.
Why? What had he done? It was stupid, but Moist couldn't resist it.
Do not jest, sir, do not jest, said Cribbin solemnly. I'm a changed man, a changed man. It is my task to pass on the good news, sir.
Here, with the speed of a snake's tongue, Cribbins produced a battered tin from inside his greasy jacket.
My crimes weigh me down like chains of hot iron, sir, like chains, but I am a man anxious to unburden himself by means of good works and confession, the last being most important. I have to get a lot off my chest before I can sleep easy, sir.
He rattled the box.
For the kiddies, sir.
This would probably work better if I hadn't seen you do this before, Moist thought. The penitent thief must be one of the oldest cons in the book. He said,
Well, I'm glad to hear it, Mr. Cribbins. I'm sorry I'm not the old friend you're looking for. Let me give you a couple of dollars, for the kiddies.
The coin clanked on the bottom of the tin.
Thank you kindly, Mr. Spangler, said Cribbins.
Moist flashed a little smile. In fact, I'm not Mr. Spangler, Mr. I called him Cribbins just then. I called him Cribbins. Did he tell me his name? Did he notice?
He must have noticed.
I beg your pardon, I mean Reverend, he managed, and the average person would not have noticed the tiny pause and the quite adroit save, but Cribbins wasn't average.
Thank you, Mr. Lipwig, he said,
and Moist heard the drawn-out Mr. and the explosively sardonic Lipwig. They meant gotcha. Cribbins winked at Moist and strolled off through the banking hall, shaking his tin, his teeth accompanying him with a medley of horrible dental noises.
"Woe and thrice woe is the man who steals my words, for his tongue shall cleave to the roof of his mouth. Spare a few coppers for the poor orphans, brothers and sisters, to those that have been given this, generally speaking."
"I shall call them guards," said Mr. Bent firmly. "We don't allow beggars in the bank." Moist grabbed his arm.
"No,"
he said urgently. "Not with all these people in here. Manhandling a man of the cloth and all that, it won't look good. I think he'll be going soon."
"Now he'll let me stew," thought Moist, as Cribbins headed nonchalantly toward the door.
"That's his way. He'll spin it out. Then he'll hit me for money, again and again." Okay, but what could Cribbins prove? But did there need to be proof? If he started talking about Albert Spangler, it could get bad. Would Vetinari throw him to the wolves? He might. He probably would. You could bet your hat that he wouldn't play the resurrection game without lots of contingency plans. Well, he had some time at least. Cribbins wouldn't go for a quick kill. He liked to watch people wriggle.
"Are you all right?" said Bent.
Moist came back to reality.
"What? Oh, fine," he said. "You should not encourage that sort of person in here, you know."
Moist shook himself.
"You are right about that, Mr. Bent. Let's get to the mint, shall we?"
"Yes, sir, but I warn you, Mr. Lipwig, these men will not be won over by fancy words."
"Inspectors," said Mr. Shady 10 minutes later, turning the word over in his mouth like a candy.
"I need people who value the high traditions of the mint," said Moist, and did not add, "like making coins very, very slowly and taking your work home with you."
"Inspectors," said Mr. Shady again.
Behind him, the men of the sheds held their caps in their hands and watched Moist owlishly, except when Mr. Shady was speaking, then they stared at the back of the man's neck. They were all in Mr. Shady's official shed, which was built high upon the wall, like a swallow's nest. It creaked whenever anyone moved.
"And, of course, some of you will still be needed to deal with the outworkers," Moist went on. "But in the main, it'll be your job to see that Mr. Spools's men arrive on time, comport themselves as they should, and observe proper security."
"Security?"
said Mr. Shady, as if tasting the word. Moist saw a flicker of evil light in the eyes of the men. It said, "These buggers will be taking over our mint, but they'll have to go past us to get out the door. Ho, ho!"
"And, of course, you can keep the sheds," said Moist.
"I also have plans for commemorative coins and other items, so your skills will not be wasted. Fair enough?" Mr. Shady looked at his fellows and then back to Moist.
"We'd like to talk about this," he said.
Moist nodded at him and at Bent, and led the way down the creaking, swaying staircase to the floor of the mint, where the parts of the new press were already being stacked up. Bent gave a little shudder when he saw it.
They won't accept, you know, he said with unconcealed hope in his voice. They've been doing things the same way here for hundreds of years, and they are craftsmen.
So were the people who used to make knives out of flint, said Moist. In truth, he'd been amazed at himself. It must have been the encounter with Cribbins. It had made his brain race.
Look, I don't like to see skills unused, he said, but I'll give them better wages and a decent job and use of the sheds. They wouldn't get an offer like that 100 years.
Someone was coming down the swaying stairs. Moist recognised him as young Alf, who, amazingly, had managed to be employed in the mint while still too young to shave, though definitely old enough to have spots.
The men say, will there be badges? Said the boy.
Actually, I was thinking of uniforms, said Moist. Silver breastplate with the city's coat of arms on it, and lightweight silver chain mail to look impressive when we have visitors.
The boy pulled a piece of paper out of his pocket and consulted it.
What about clipboards? He said.
Certainly, said Moist, and whistles, too.
And, it's definite about the sheds, right?
I'm a man of my word, said Moist.
And you are a man of words, Mr. Lipwig, said Bent as the boy scuttled back up the rocking steps.
But I fear they will lead us into ruin. The bank needs solidarity, reliability, everything that gold represents.
Moist spun around. It had not been a good day. It had not been a good night, either.
Mr. Bent, if you do not like what I am doing, feel free to leave. You'll have a good reference, and all the wages due to you.
Bent looked as though he'd been slapped.
Leave the bank? Leave the bank? How could I do that? How dare you?
A door slammed above them. They looked up. The men of the sheds were coming down the stairs in solemn procession.
Now we shall see, hissed Bent. These are men of solid worth. They'll have nothing to do with your gaudy offer, Mr. Ringmaster.
The men reached the bottom of the steps. Without a word, they all looked at Mr. Shady, except for Mr. Shady, who looked at Moist.
The sheds stay, right? He said. You're giving in, said Mr. Bent, aghast, after hundreds of years.
Well,
said Mr. Shady, me and the boys had a bit of a talk, and well, at a time like this, a man's got to think of his shed, and the outworkers will be all right, right?
Mr. Shady, I'd go to the barricades for the Elim, said Moist.
And we talked to some of the lads from the post office last night, and they said we could trust Mr. Lipwig's word, 'cause he's as straight as a corkscrew.
A corkscrew? Said Bent, shocked.
Yeah, we asked about that too, said Shady, and they said he acts curly, but that's okay, 'cause he damn well gets the corks out.
Mr. Bent's expression went blank.
Oh, he said, this is clearly some kind of judgment-clouding joke, which I do not understand. If you will excuse me, I have a great deal of work to attend to.
His feet rising and falling, as though he was walking on an invisible staircase, Mr. Bent departed in jerky haste.
Very well, gentlemen. Thank you for your helpful attitude, said Moist, watching the retreating figure. And for my part, I will get those uniforms ordered this afternoon.
You're a fast mover, master, said Mr. Shady.
Stand still, and your mistakes catch up with you, said Moist.
They laughed, because he'd said it, but the face of Cribbins rose up in his mind, and, quite unconsciously, he put his hand in his pocket and touched the blackjack. He'd have to learn how to use it now, because a weapon you held and didn't know how to use belonged to your enemy.
He'd bought it.
Why?
Because it was like the lockpicks, a token to prove, if only to himself, that he hadn't given in, not all the way, that a part of him was still free. It was like the other ready-made identities, the escape plans, the caches of money and clothes. They told him that any day he could leave all this, melt into the crowd, say goodbye to the paperwork and the timetable and the endless, endless wanting. They told him that he could give it up any time he liked, any hour, any minute, any second. And because he could, he didn't. Every hour, every minute, every second. There had to be a reason why.
Mr. Lipwig! Mr. Lipwig!
A young clerk dodged and weaved through the busyness of the mint and stopped in front of Moist, panting.
Mr. Lipwig, there's a lady in the hall to see you, and we've thanked her for not smoking 3 times, and she's still doing it.
The image of the wretched Cribbins vanished and was replaced with a much better one.
Ah, yes. That reason.
Miss Adorabelle Deerhart, known to Moist as Spike, was standing in the middle of the banking hall. Moist just headed for the smoke.
Hello, you, she said, and that was that. Can you take me away from all this?
She gestured with her non-smoking hand. Staff had meaningfully surrounded her with tall brass ashtrays full of white sand. Moist shifted a couple of them and let her out.
"How was—" he began, but she interrupted. "We can talk on the way."
"Where are we going?" Moist asked hopefully.
"Unseen University," said Adora Bell, heading for the door. She had a large woven bag on her shoulder. It was apparently stuffed with straw.
"Not lunch, then," said Moist.
"Lunch can wait. This is important."
"Oh."
It was lunchtime at Unseen University, where every meal is important. It was hard to find a time when some meal or other was not in progress there. The library was unusually empty, and Adora Bell walked up to the nearest wizard who did not seem gainfully employed, and demanded, "I want to see the Cabinet of Curiosity right away."
"I don't think we have anything like that," said the wizard. "Who's it by?"
"Please don't lie. My name is Adora Bell Dearheart, so, as you can imagine, I've got a pretty short temper. My father brought me with him when you people asked him to come and look at the cabinet about 20 years ago. You wanted to find out how the doors worked. Someone must remember. It was in a big room, a very big room, and it had lots and lots of drawers. And the funny thing about them was—" The wizard raised his hands quickly, as if to ward off further words.
"Can you wait just 1 minute?" he suggested.
They waited for 5. Occasionally a pointy-hatted head peered around a bookshelf to look at them, and ducked away if it thought it had been spotted. Adora Bell lit a fresh cigarette. Moist pointed to a sign which said, "If you are smoking, thank you for being beaten about the head." "That's just for show," said Adora Bell, expelling a stream of blue smoke. "All wizards smoke like chimneys."
"Not in here, I notice," said Moist. "And possibly this is because of all the highly inflammable books. It might be a good idea to—"
He felt the swish of the air and got a whiff of rainforest as something heavy swung overhead and disappeared upward into the gloom, now trailing a stream of blue smoke.
"Hey! Someone took my—"
Adora Bell began, but Moist pushed her out of the way as the thing swung back again and a banana knocked his hat off. "They are a bit more definite about things here," he said, picking up his hat. "If it's any comfort, the librarian probably intended to hit me. He can be quite gallant."
"Ah, you're Mr. Litwig, I recognise the suit,"
said an elderly wizard who clearly hoped he was appearing as if by magic, but in fact had appeared as if by stepping out from behind a bookcase.
"I know I am the Chair of Indefinite Studies here for my sins, and you, by a process of elimination, will be Miss Dearheart, who remembers the Cabinet of Curiosity."
The Chair of Indefinite Studies stepped closer and looked conspiratorial. He lowered his voice.
"I wonder if I can persuade you to forget about it."
"Not a chance," said Adora Bell.
"We like to think of it as one of our better-kept secrets, you see."
"Good. I'll help you keep it," said Adora Bell.
"Nothing I could say could change your mind."
"I don't know," said Adora Bell.
"Abracadabra, maybe. Got your spell book?"
Moist was impressed at that. She could be spiky.
"Oh, that type of lady," said the Chair of Indefinite Studies wearily. "Modern. Oh, well, I suppose you'd better come with me, then."
"What's this all about, please?" hissed Moist, as they followed the wizard.
"I need something translated," said Adora Bell, "in a hurry."
"Aren't you glad to see me?"
"Oh, yes, lots. But I need something translated in a hurry."
"And this cabinet thing can help?"
"Perhaps."
"Perhaps?"
"Perhaps could wait till after lunch, couldn't it? If it was definitely, now I could have seen the point."
"Oh, dear, I'm afraid I'm lost again, and through no fault of my own, I might add," grumbled the Chair of Indefinite Studies. "I'm afraid they keep changing the parameters and they do leak so. I don't know, what with one thing and another, you can't call your door your own these days."
"What were your sins?" said Moist, giving up on Adora Bell.
"Pardon? Oh, dear, what is that stain on the ceiling? Probably best not to know."
"What were the sins you committed in order to become the Chair of Indefinite Studies?"
"Oh, I just tend to say that for something to say," said the wizard, opening a door and slamming it again quickly. "But right now I'm inclined to think I must have committed a few, and they must have been whoppers. It's just unbearable just now, of course. They're saying that everything in the whole wretched universe is technically indefinable, but what am I supposed to do about it? And of course, this damned cabinet is playing havoc with the place again. I thought we'd seen the last of it 15 years ago. Oh, yes, mind the squid. We're a bit puzzled about that, actually. Ah, here's the right door," the chair sniffed. "And it's 25 feet away from where it ought to be. What did I tell you?"
The door opened, and then it was just a matter of knowing where to start. Moist opted for letting his jaw drop, which was clean and simple. The room was bigger than it ought to be. No room ought to be more than a mile across, especially when outside in the corridor, which looked quite ordinary if you ignored the giant squid, it appeared to have perfectly normal rooms on either side of it. It shouldn't have a ceiling so high that you couldn't see it, either. It simply should not fit. "It's quite easy to do this, actually," said the Chair of Indefinite Studies as they stared. "At least, so they tell me," he added wistfully. "Apparently, if you shrink time, you can expand space." "But how do they do that?" Moist asked, staring at the structure that was the Cabinet of Curiosity. "I'm proud to say I haven't got the faintest idea," said the Chair. "Frankly, I'm afraid I got rather lost around about the time we stopped using dribbly candles. I know it's technically my department, but I find it best just to let them get on with it. They do insist on trying to explain things, which of course does not help." Moist, if he'd had any mental picture at all, was expecting a cabinet. After all, that's what it was called, yes? But what filled most of the impossible room was a tree, in the general shape of a venerable spreading oak. It was a tree in winter, there were no leaves. And then, when the mind had found a familiar, friendly metaphor, it had to come to terms with the fact that the tree was made of filing cabinets. They appeared to be wooden ones, but this didn't help much. High up in what had to be called the branches, wizards on broomsticks were engaged in who knew what. They looked like insects.
It is a bit of a shock when you see it for the first time, isn't it? Said a friendly voice.
Moist looked around at a young wizard, at least by the standards of wizards, who had round spectacles, a clipboard, and the shiny sort of expression that says, I probably know more than you can possibly imagine, but I'm still reasonably happy to talk even to people like you. You're Ponder Stibbons, right? Said Moist. The only one who does any work in the university? Other wizards turned their heads at this, and Ponder went red.
Oh, that's quite untrue. I just pull my weight like any other member of the faculty, he said,
but a slight cast in his expression indicated that perhaps the other faculty members had far too much weight and not enough pull.
I'm in charge of the cabinet project for my sins.
Why? What did you do? Said Moist. Something worse?
I'd volunteered to take it over, said Ponder. And I have to say that we have learned more in the past 6 months than in the past 25 years. The cabinet is a truly amazing artifact.
Where did you find it?
In the attic, tucked behind a collection of stuffed frogs. We think people gave up trying to make it work years ago. Of course, that was back in the dribbly candle era, said Ponder, earning a snort from the Chair of Indefinite Studies. Modern technomancy is somewhat more useful.
All right, then, said Moist.
What does it do?
We don't know.
How does it work?
We don't know.
Where did it come from?
We don't know.
Well, that seems to be all, said Moist sarcastically. Oh, no, one last one. What is it? And let me tell you, I'm agog. That may be the wrong sort of question to ask, said Ponder, shaking his head. Technically, it appears to be a classic bag of holding, but with N mouths, where N is the number of items in an 11-dimensional universe, which are not currently alive, not pink, and can fit in a cubical drawer 14.14 inches on a side divided by P.
What's P?
That may be the wrong sort of question.
When I was a little girl, it was just a magic box, Adora Bell broke in a dreamy voice. It was in a much smaller room, and when it unfolded a few times, there was a box with a golem's foot in it.
Ah, yes, in the third iteration, said Ponder. They couldn't get much further than that in those days. Now, of course, we've got controlled recursion and aim-driven folding that effectively reduces collateral boxing to 0.13%, a 12-fold improvement in the last year alone.
That's great, said Moist, feeling that it was the least he could do.
Does Miss Dearheart want to see the item again? Said Ponder, lowering his voice.
Adora Bell still had a faraway look in her eyes.
I think so, said Moist. She's very big on golems. We were about to fold up for today, in any case, said Ponder. It won't hurt to pick up the foot on the way.
He took a large megaphone from a bench and held it to his lips.
The cabinet closes in 3 minutes, gentlemen. All researchers inside the safety area now, please. Be there or be square.
Be there or be square, said Moist, as Ponder lowered the megaphone.
Oh, a couple of years ago, someone ignored the warning, and, when the cabinet folded up, he temporarily became a curiosity.
You mean he ended up inside a 14-inch cube?
Mostly. Look, we really would be very happy if you didn't tell anyone about the cabinet, thank you. We know how to use it, we think, but it might not be the way it was intended to be used. We don't know what it's for, as you put it, or who built it, or even if they are completely the wrong questions to ask. And nothing in it is bigger than about 14 inches square, but we don't know why this is, or who it is who decides they are curious, or why, and we certainly don't know why it contains nothing pink. It's all very embarrassing. I'm sure you can keep a secret, Mr. Litvig.
You'd be amazed.
Oh, why?
That's the wrong kind of question.
You do know something quite important about the cabinet, said Adora Bell, apparently waking up. You know it wasn't built for or by a girl between the ages of 4 and 11 years old.
How do we know that?
No pink. Trust me, no girl in that age group would leave out pink.
Are you sure? Oh, that's wonderful, said Ponder, making a note on his clipboard. That's certainly worth knowing. Let's get the foot, then, shall we?
The broomstick-riding wizards had touched down now. Ponder cleared his throat and picked up the megaphone.
All down? Wonderful. Hex, be so good as to fold, please.
There was silence for a while, and then a distant clattering noise began to grow up near the ceiling. It sounded like gods shuffling wooden playing cards that happened to be a mile high.
Hex is our thinking engine, said Ponder. We'd hardly be able to explore the box at all without him.
The clattering was becoming louder and faster.
You might find your ears aching, said Ponder, raising his voice. Hex tries to control the speed, but it takes finite time for the ventilators to get air back into the room. The volume of the cabinet changes very fast, you see.
This was shouted against the thunder of collapsing drawers. They slammed in on themselves far too fast for the human eye to follow as the edifice shrunk and folded and slid and rattled down into house size, shed size, and finally, in the middle of the huge space, unless it was some kind of time, stood a small polished cabinet, about a foot and a half on a side, standing on 4 beautifully carved legs. The cabinet's doors clicked shut.
Slowly unfold to specimen 1109, said Ponder in the ringing silence.
The doors opened, a deep drawer slid out. It went on sliding.
Just follow me, said Ponder, strolling toward the cabinet. It's fairly safe.
A drawer about 100 yards long has just slid out of a box about 14 inches square, said Moist, in case he was the only one to notice.
Yes, that's what happens, said Ponder as the drawer slid back about halfway.
Its side, Moist saw, was a line of drawers. So drawers opened out of drawers. Of course, Moist thought. In 11-dimensional space, that was the wrong thing to think.
It's a sliding puzzle, said the doorbell, but with lots more directions to slide. That is a very graphic analogy which aids understanding wonderfully while being, strictly speaking, wrong in every possible way, said Ponder.
Adora Bell's eyes narrowed. She had not had a cigarette in 10 minutes. The long drawer extruded another drawer at right angles. All along the sides of it were, yes, yet more drawers. One of these extended slowly. Moist took a risk and tapped on what appeared to be perfectly ordinary wood. It made a perfectly ordinary noise.
"Should I worry that I just saw a drawer slide through another drawer?" he said.
"No," said Ponder. "The cabinet is trying to make 4-dimensional sense of something that is happening in 11 or possibly 10.
"Trying? Do you mean it's alive?"
"Aha! The right type of question. I bet you don't know the answer, though." "You are correct. But you must admit it's an interesting question not to know the answer to. And yes, here we have the foot. Hold and collapse, please, Hex."
The drawers collapsed back into themselves in a series of crashes, much shorter and less dramatic than before, leaving the cabinet looking demure and antique and slightly bow-legged.
It had little claws as feet, a cabinet-maker's affectation that always annoyed Moist in a low-grade way. Did they think the things moved around in the night? Or maybe the cabinet really did. And the cabinet's doors were open. Nestling inside, and only just fitting, was a golem's foot. Once, golems were delicate and beautiful. Once, the very best sculptors probably made them to rival the most beautiful of statues. But long since then, the fumble-fingered many who could barely make a snake out of clay found that bashing the stuff into the shape of a big, hulking gingerbread man worked just as well. This foot was one of the early kind. It was made of a clay-like white china, with patterns of tiny raised markings in yellow, black and red. A little brass plate in front of it was engraved, in Uberwaldian, Foot of Umnian Golem, Middle Period. Well, whoever made the cabinet comes from... Anyone looking at the labels sees it in their native tongue, said Ponder wearily. The markings apparently indicate that it did indeed come from the city of according to the late Professor Fleed. Said Moist. What? They weren't sure to call the place. Just said Ponder. Very ancient, about 60,000 years, I believe, back in the clay age. The first golem makers, said Adorabel. She unslung the bag and started to rummage in the straw. Moist tapped the foot. It seemed eggshell thin. It's some sort of ceramic, said Ponder. No one knows how they made it. The Umnians even baked boats out of the stuff. Did they work? Up to a point, said Ponder. Anyway, the city was totally destroyed in the first war with the ice giants. There's nothing there now. We think that the foot was put in the cabinet a long time ago. Or will be dug up sometime in the future, perhaps, said Moist. That could very well be the case, said Ponder gravely. In which case, won't that be a bit of a problem? I mean, can it be in the ground and in the cabinet at the same time? That, Mr. Lipvig, is the wrong type of question? Yes. The box exists in 10 or possibly 11 dimensions. Practically anything may be possible. Why only 11 dimensions? We don't know, said Ponder. It might be simply that more would be silly. Can you take the foot out, please? Said Adorabel, who was now brushing wisps of straw off a long package. Ponder nodded, lifted out the relic with great care, and placed it gently on the bench behind them. What would have happened if you had dropped... Moist began. Wrong type of question, Mr. Lipvig. Adorabel put the bundle down beside the foot and unwrapped it with care. It contained a part of a golem's arm, 2 feet long. I knew it. The markings are the same, she said. And there's a lot more on my piece. Can you translate it? Me? No, said Ponder. The arts are not my field, he added, in a way that suggested his was a pretty superior field with much better flowers in it. You need Professor Fleed. You mean the one who's dead, said Moist. He's... dead at the moment, but I'm sure that in the interests of discretion, my colleague Dr. Hicks can arrange for the professor to talk to you after lunch. When he'll be less dead, said Moist. When Dr. Hicks has had lunch, said Ponder patiently. Professor Fleed will be pleased to receive visitors, especially Miss Dearheart. He is the world expert on Umnian. Every word has hundreds of meanings, I understand. Can I take the foot? Said Adorabel. No, said Ponder. It's ours. That was the wrong type of answer, said Adorabel, picking up the foot. On behalf of the Golem Trust, I am acquiring this golem. If you can prove ownership, we will pay you a fair price for it. Would that it were that simple, said Ponder, politely taking it from her. But, you see, if our curiosity is taken away from the cabinet room for more than 14 hours and 14 seconds, the cabinet stops working. Last time, it took us 3 months to restart it. But you can drop in at any time to check that we're not mistreating it. Moist laid a hand on Adorabel's arm to forestall an incident. She's very passionate about golems, he said. The Trust digs them up all the time. That's very commendable, said Stibbons. I'll talk to Dr. Hicks. He's the head of the Department of Post-Mortem Communications. Post-Mortem Commi... Moist began. Isn't that the same as necromant... I said, the Department of Post-Mortem Communications, said Ponder very firmly. I suggest you come back at 3 o'clock.
"'Did anything about that conversation strike you as normal?' said Moist as they stepped out into the sunlight. "'Actually, I thought it went very well,' said Adora Bell. "'This wasn't how I imagined your homecoming,' said Moist. "'Why the rush? Is there some problem?'
"'Look, we found 4 golems at the dig,' said Adora Bell.
"'That's good, yes?' said Moist.
"'Yes. And you know how deep they were?
I couldn't guess.
Guess?'
"'I don't know,' said Moist, bewildered at suddenly having to play What's My Depth. 200 feet down? That's more than half a mile underground.
Impossible! That's deeper than coal! Keep it down, will you?
Look, is there somewhere we can go and talk?
How about the Royal Bank of Ankh-Morpork? There's a private dining room.
And they'll let us eat there, will they?
Oh, yes, the chairman is a great friend of mine, said Moist.
He is, has he?
"'He certainly is,' said Moist. "'Why, only this morning he licked my face.'
Adora Bell stopped and turned to stare at him.
"'Really?' she said.
"'Then it's just as well I got back when I did.